In the 1960s and 70s, the Gambino crime family was arguably the most powerful underworld organization in New York City. Its power structure seemed carved in stone, and membership was all but impossible for a young entrepreneur with aspirations of the mob life. But for one man, exclusion from this family was not going to be an option, and he knew of only two ways to achieve his aspirations. One was to earn, and the other was to murder. He accomplished the first by streamlining the auto theft industry, and the other by streamlining human atrocity. This is the legend of Roy DeMeo.
I wouldn't know a gunman if I saw one.
The gangster era's come. Five feuds of public enemies bring a reign of terror and baffle police.
How did this famous gangster treat you?
He treated me wonderful.
This here, what I'm telling you, what I'm exposing, this is my doom, 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 doom.
Hey, they need to know what's going on at this. Some bitchy shit going on.
But that's the best thing I want to hear right off the bat is that you work for the feds. That's the first thing he says to me. Give me a break. So if you're a gangster and you got to get on LinkedIn these days, is that how they're doing it? Like you're looking for a gang.
Well, I mean, you don't mail in applications anymore.
No. So, and you have to pick. What do you put as your best skills? What's number one?
People person?
Yeah.
Sociable?
I like your take on that they don't do written resumes anymore. Not like the old days where they had to like handpick and type that and turn it into Carlo Gambino. Although they did do references.
Yes. The word of mouth carried very far.
Endorsed by Vito Genovese.
Yeah, Vito Genovese liked your leadership skills, like Tab.
Like, you know those emails you get, Brett, when it's like, congratulate so-and-so on starting their new position? So it's like, congratulate Carmine on starting a crime family.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. You're like, well, you know, Carmine Galani likes me. Like, Carmine? Jeez. He's a dick!
I can't imagine LinkedIn mobsters.
Mobsters.
You've got like a faked relative of reference from Carmine Galani, and it's just like glowing. It's just glowing about you, you know? Like, that's such a night. They're like, you don't know Carmine Galani, do you, son? No, I don't.
You log in because it'll suggest, like, you might know this person or they might be in your network. You log in, it's like, you might know the FBI. No. Decline.
You might know some guy you just killed. No.
I don't know who that is.
I did know him. Not anymore.
Welcome back to Partners in Crime for a super special Halloween episode. I'm Bill Crooks, your creepy guide through this house of horrors. Horrors. Relax, folks. I come here all the time. Well, it's you try to say horrors, but that's almost worse.
Yeah.
You know, now it seems like there's whores and then the horrors that come to visit the whores.
Well, you'll never see Vito there. Or not Vito, Ori.
Ori? No, he doesn't need it. Okay. When you think of Halloween colors, what do you think of, Joshua?
Orange.
And when you think of orange, you think of?
Zach the Zip. Griffith. I don't appreciate it. It was an honest mistake.
Then across the table, he once ate a ghost and thought it tasted like sheet. I stole that from a fourth grader. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the one and only Brett Sexton.
Good material you're taking. It's good material.
And at the control station, he reminds me of Casper the Friendly Ghost, Joshua the Intern.
He got me there.
You gotta admit, though, he's got the complexion of Casper the Ghost.
He does. He does.
Shave if Joshua him. Was any wider, you'd see through him.
Shave his head.
And he ain't that friendly. Okay, so a lot of times we're talking about how it's impossible to be in the mob because of computers and all the technology and stuff. So it seems like it'd be impossible, you know, for you to be a mafia boss and just float around undetected, right? Even if you ran your credit card or something, you're figuring the feds know exactly where you are, right?
Yeah.
Not in Spain. So this week in mafia news, I pulled up this little gem.
Poor Spaniards.
Vittorio Rosso, an Italian mafia boss whom the Spanish police had been after for 2 years, has disappeared following his arrest in Barcelona. The 41-year-old Rosso, who is believed to be one of the leaders of the 'Ndrangheta crime syndicate from the Italian region of Calabria, was let go after making statements via video link to a judge at Spain's High Court. The courthouse said at the time of his initial hearing, it was believed that the suspect was only wanted on extortion charges, and that it was only 2 hours after his release that it emerged that Rosso was also a mafia boss. The judge in charge of the case has issued a new arrest warrant. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Police sources note that the court received an extensive police report explaining who Rosso was, together with a copy of European arrest warrants issued by Italy. This country later sent additional information on the suspect's ties to organized crime, but by then, Rosso had already been released from a holding cell in Barcelona.
See, to me, that could be one of a couple things. Number one, just total incompetence by the cops. Number two, maybe there's a cover-up. Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe he just flipped somebody some cash and they let him out.
I'm betting on incompetence. That's what I'm betting on.
It's a lot easier to bribe your way out of like a Spain than would be in the U.S., I feel like.
Yeah, you're right. It's not like it was in Italy and they let him go.
Yeah.
Nah, yeah, I think it's just some boob let him go.
And then to get these documents from Italy, like, you let him go?
Wait.
Here's who you let go, by the way. And they just email all these documents to him.
Shit.
This guy's like, it's my first day.
Well, maybe they'll be too mad. Maybe they'll a little slap on the wrist.
We'll find him. Right?
Well, hey, no harm done, guys. We'll call him. We'll tell him to come back that there was a mistake.
Yeah.
We'll tell him he left his keys here.
That's weird. It says the number's disconnected. I can't reach him.
Oh, Lord.
Incompetence.
Yeah.
Look at the Knicks. You can't cure incompetence.
You can't. No matter how much money you throw at it.
So, Roy DeMeo has no nickname. Find this astounding.
They've all got him. Either they give him to themselves or they earn it, but I feel like they've all got him.
I saw nothing that said he had a nickname. Yeah, I mean, you think he'd be the Butcher or something, but there's already a Butcher. Thomas Patera was the Butcher.
What'd he do?
He butchered.
Thomas
if DeMeo
Patera
was in like a Batman movie, he'd be like Jigsaw. But I don't think the Italians think like that. All right, let's get started.
Roy Albert DeMeo is born on September 7th, 1940, to a hardworking Italian immigrant family in the Bath Beach neighborhood of Brooklyn. The DeMeos hail from the Naples region. Although his immediate family is described as poor, Roy's uncles hold successful positions, one as a prosecuting attorney and another as a forensic scientist. His mother reportedly hopes he'll become a doctor, but time would reveal him to be more of a butcher than a surgeon.
It's actually kind of works out if you think about it. One is in prosecution,
yeah,
and the other is in forensics.
Covering all the grounds.
Yeah.
They're going to become big fans of his work before the day is up.
Little nephew Roy. Unlike most mobsters of his day, Roy takes the time to complete school, doing so from James Madison High School in 1969. During his high school years, he first seeks employment as a delivery boy and then as a butcher's apprentice. Realizing that these honest pursuits afford little in the way of serious money, DeMeo starts a small loan sharking business. He loans money to various young hoodlums in his neighborhood and doles out merciless beatings to anyone that comes up short on interest payments. By the end of the 1960s, his loan sharking business has grown in scope and sophistication. As his criminal enterprises thrive, Roy DeMeo begins to have a larger vision of what his future should hold. Specifically, DeMeo aspires to become a made member of an Italian crime family. As luck would have it, he eventually catches the eye of one Anthony Nino Gaggi, a captain in the Gambino crime family.
So DeMeo kind of reminds me of Goodfellas in the beginning when Henry Hill goes, "All my life I wanted to be a gangster." You know, this is his whole goal in life. You know, he's not the accidental gangster of Ori Spades.
Had to be at that cab stand.
Yeah, but the whole nature of loan sharking, I think, it's misunderstood. It's not like somebody's, they can't pay their electric bill, right? So you help them out with a couple of $100 and now they're on the hook. You know, it doesn't work like that. What it'll be is some guy has a big idea, or he gets into, he gets a line on a bunch of cocaine, something like that. But he needs like $5,000 to put up for the cocaine. But on the street, it's got a value of like $20,000. And all he's got to do is borrow the money and then not do the coke, right? And it can work out. But the problem is you're going to pay a huge amount of interest, usually 25 to 26% interest. I'm going with the under because I don't think they can do the math most of the time.
No.
So you owe 25%. So it's taking a big chunk of your change right there. And you've got to make your interest payments. It's called a VIG, right? So you got to make your VIG right off the bat. You're paying the interest, paying the interest, paying the interest. You miss one, they double it right off the bat. So now you're paying 50% interest on the money you borrowed and you're feeling the freaking heat. So these guys aren't necessarily, they had these pie in the sky dreams of making a bunch of money, yeah. But in the end, they're lucky to get the hell out of there, right? I think you miss three VIGs, you get a physical warning, right? Jeez. And after that, you're killed.
Yeah.
And so it's a rough business and stuff. And lots of shit happened. Did you ever see, not The Irishman, but Kill the Irishman?
I saw a little bit of it. I never finished it, though.
James Woods is in it.
And Lester Diamond.
So this guy borrows money from the Bonannos, right? He wants to borrow from James Wood. James Wood's this Jewish entrepreneur kind of guy. He goes, oh, I never loan my own money, but I can get you the loan from the Bonanno family, right? And he's going to open a restaurant. That's his whole goal, right? So he borrows, I forget how much, say it's 50 grand or 200 grand, whatever it is. He borrows it from the Bonannos, right? There's this black guy that's a courier, and he's going to bring it to him. But that guy gets all high, and maybe he pilfers a little bit of the money, and he gets high on it. And then some shit goes wrong, and he gets arrested, and they catch him with all this money, and the cops seize the money and throw him in jail. So James Woods comes up to the guy, and he's like, hey, I got some bad news. You know, the money was on its way, but the guy got stoned, and the money was seized.
The guy was coked out.
He goes, so, you know, that's a problem. And the guy's like, well, it's not my freaking problem. I never got the money. You know, James Woods is looking at him. He goes, I don't understand. You got to pay that money. He goes, I'm not paying the money. I never got it. And then James Woods has this incredulous look on his face like, the hell you mean?
This doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And so like the rest of the time, he's trying to blow up this guy and stuff. But yeah, but he's not like, you know, hey, I know it's a bad deal. He's like, I don't understand why you think you don't owe this money.
Yeah.
But this is the kind of shit that happens. You know what I mean? Like you have this great plan and shit goes wrong. Your stash gets robbed. You get robbed, you know, but one little thing happens, man, and you're in a bad, bad shape with these guys. And it's really how loan sharking goes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's other kinds of things like, you know, the mob owned the garment district.
Yep.
So a designer wants to come out with a line of clothes. This was actually an example they gave in one of the things I saw. He wants to do this whole big show designer thing, and a bank's not going to loan him money based on his vision and stuff. The mob will. And the mob's tied into the unions and all the other stuff. So they give him the money to run it at a huge interest and stuff. This guy's in the same boat now. It better take off and take off quick and stuff. So really, I'd think twice before you go this route for loaning money.
Yeah.
If a bank doesn't want to loan you the money, there's a reason.
That's, I mean, it's a lose-lose because once you get into that debt, you can't go to the police because you're doing illegal things.
Right.
It's like you're screwed. If you don't have the leverage or power to back yourself up, they can set the whatever, 25%, 50%. What are you going to do?
Oh, yeah. When you're dealing with the Gambinos, you go to the police, you're as good as dead.
Yeah. It's like,
yeah, they're not.
Yeah. You have you either flee and hopefully don't get killed or running away, or you just find the money. There's nothing you can do.
You know, you said these guys aren't good at math. We haven't come across anybody whose nickname is the mathematician.
That's true.
Like, so how much do I owe you? A lot. You owe me a lot.
Gotta crunch the numbers later, but it's a hefty number, I'm for sure.
You're gonna feel it.
I've noticed some stupid people get really smart when the money comes around. You know what I mean? Like they can't do shit at work, but man, if their check is 30 cents light, you know, they're like, I think I was taxed at a bad rate.
Start busting out the calculator.
Exactly. All of a sudden they're brilliant. You know?
Out of the last penny.
So DeMeo's basically running these various racketeering schemes, hoping to get noticed, and he actually gets a phone call at his house from the house of Gaji.
He's a free agent.
He's like, hey, I want to meet with you and stuff. And it's like an exciting time for him where most people would be like, oh, shit. You know, he's like, yeah. It's the moment I've been waiting for, you know. So he must have been running a serious scheme to get the attention of these guys and get a personal phone call, an invitation to come over.
Gaji tells DeMeo that even more money can be made by working directly for the Gambino family. He officially decrees that Roy DeMeo will act as an associate, placing him on the first rung of a long ladder to being a made man. DeMeo and Gaji proved to be a good team, working together to expand their various rackets to a mutual advantage. While their business interests are very much aligned, their personas are very different. Anthony Gaji is the classic gentleman gangster and works very closely with Paul Castellano, the heir apparent to Carlo Gambino. Roy DeMeo, by contrast, is more of a street thug who's getting things done in the trenches. DeMeo is becoming what is known as an earner, and everybody loves an earner. DeMeo proves himself to be more than just a loan shark, expanding his talents to include theft and other entrepreneurial pursuits. That's a good way to put it.
Entrepreneurial. He's an entrepreneur.
That's on his LinkedIn.
Yeah. Self-starter.
It's just like politics. When we start using a euphemism, something really bad's going on.
At this time, hardcore pornography is illegal. And although most Italian crime families, including the Gambinos, look down upon such activities, Roy sees it as an opportunity to make a ton of money. Roy is right. He makes so much money, in fact, that his boss Gaji, and presumably Gambino, are willing to look the other way as long as a steady stream of cash flows in.
So Roy also becomes a silent partner in a peep show and a prostitution establishment in New Jersey after the owner of his business becomes unable to pay his loan sharking debts. So Roy's beginning to deal in pornography. When they say that Roy's getting involved in hardcore pornography, I don't know what you're thinking, but we're talking about, like, not just humans. Stuff that you don't want to get caught with.
Hate to see it.
Yeah, this is what he's doing. It's some really nasty, dirty stuff that Roy's doing. And this is like, it's not some gentle, soft porn that the Gambinos are opposed to. It's stuff that makes the Gambinos go, "What the hell?" You know, this is what they're dealing in.
Who's watching this?
Yeah, Jesus. Exactly. What kind of a sicko as they're cutting someone's head off in a ditch?
That's messed up. That's just, I don't know how anyone could sit there and watch garbage.
I just want to make sure we're all on the same page of what we're talking about here.
1972 also sees DeMeo's financial skills manifest into a lucrative position in an above-board organization called the Brooklyn Credit Union. The opportunity is created by Gaji as a means of reorganizing the banking institution and exert their mob influence over its financial dealings. DeMeo proves to be quite up to the challenge and soon introduces his credit union colleagues to another extremely lucrative side business, laundering money for his associates and supplying high-interest loans to corrupt clients with stolen credit union funds. He'd often loan money to drug dealers looking to make a big score. If the dealer couldn't make the interest payments, they'd be given a physical warning and eventually killed.
So at this time, it's not unusual for organized crime to get their tentacles into financial institutions, and somehow they've already got their meat hooks in this thing, and Gaji puts DeMeo on the board of this. At some point, he starts looking beyond. It was just supposed to launder money, but he reorganizes the thing and gets it going. He's like, "Hey, you know what? We could loan money to not good people. You know, like, we'll just loan money to drug dealers and things like that under the table too, and they'll pay us back. They're good for it, because if they don't, we'll kill them, right?" And it's basic
they have
mob
to be
stuff.
Good for it.
Yeah, but somehow he also corrupts everybody that's on the board. Like, "Hey, I'm stealing, you should be stealing too." And pretty soon everybody is embezzling from this company. Gaji's making money, he's making money. And, as much as everybody's taken from it, the thing's going to go belly up. But before it does, he's going to make around $2 million in today's economy.
So, Bill, gun to your head. You can either give your money to the Brooklyn Credit Union or Bernie Madoff. who are you picking?
It's going either way. I think I take my chances with Bernie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because Bernie's not going to shoot me between the eyes just for the hell of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll just be out money.
Yeah.
You won't be out of life.
You're out money either way. Although, yeah. I think the Brooklyn deal is probably FDIC insured.
DeMeo's loan sharking clientele primarily consists of those in the automobile industry. Eventually, he expands his clients to include a dentist's office, an abortion clinic, flea markets, and restaurants. He finds himself frequently telling his neighbors and acquaintances that he works in the construction business. along with food retailing and used cars. Speaking of Goodfellas.
Yeah.
What do? I make construction. The stream of money is flowing strong, and DeMeo realizes that he needs to protect his interests with a crew of his own. He forms a group of ruthless criminals that become known as the infamous DeMeo Crew. Chris Rosenberg, aka Chris Harvey, becomes the first member of the DeMeo Crew. Rosenberg, now 24 years old, first meets DeMeo at just 16. DeMeo and Rosenberg cross paths during a run-of-the-mill marijuana deal at a Canarsie gas station in 1966. The two strike up a business arrangement, with DeMeo loaning Rosenberg much more money than he's accustomed to, allowing Rosenberg to deal in larger amounts. Chris reportedly idolizes DeMeo and shares his dream of becoming a made man. He's known for his vicious temper, his love of stealing fast cars, and dealing drugs. When 1972 rolls around, Rosenberg has acquainted his friends with DeMeo, and they begin working for him as well. They recruit Freddie DeGnome, a Brooklyn-based drag car racer and accomplished car thief. It is said that he is more than capable of escaping law enforcement in a high-speed pursuit. DeMeo crew members also include DeMeo's cousin Joseph Dracula Guglielmo, Anthony Center, and Joseph and Patrick Testa. They also recruit an extremely talented car thief named Andre Katz. Katz is also an auto repair shop owner who has partnered with DeMeo in these stolen car schemes.
So car theft is huge in the 1970s, especially in New York. One estimate had the annual count of car thefts in New York City at 77,000 cars. So DeMeo sends his crews out every night literally to rake in as many cars as possible. And the problem with the cars they're stealing at this point is that there's serial numbers stamped in on the frames and the engines. That apparently is a big pain in the ass. But what's good is that they can rip the parts off. And the parts separately are almost worth more than the car. So they're going around, they've got all these body shops and stuff that don't ask a lot of questions, or they outright own them, right? And it's getting to the point where they can steal so many cars that, say, a guy wrecks his Porsche, he brings it in. You can order the color, make, model, and year of that Porsche, and they'll go get you one. And they've even got cops on the take, you know, so the cops can look up and tell you where that car is.
Like, that's smart.
Yeah, yeah.
The cops are always driving around. Yeah.
So it's just gotten crazy and stuff. But they said there'd be a warehouse that the cops would find, and it's literally just packed with car frames, just stacked up. Like, they don't even care. They just leave them for you. Yeah. But everything else is scrapped down, and they said that a lot of these organizations were more lucrative than General Motors was that year in making the cars.
I tried to do some math of roughly 10 years for the 70s, 77,000, maybe like 21 cars a day.
Wow.
It was like 200-something a year for like, that's the 70 of around 10-ish years. Wow. But 21 cars a day, maybe?
He said he sent 20 guys out every night to go looking.
One dude gets a car every single night.
Yeah, everybody gets a car.
That is nuts.
Yeah. It is nuts.
At some point, you got to be like, I just don't want a car in New York City.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm telling you, he was saving the cab industry. That's what he was doing.
Well, I'd take a cab, but they stole all the cabs.
Imagine if Uber was around back then. You just call an Uber and steal it.
Yeah, they'd probably just shoot the Uber guy and take it.
Yeah, sit up by the street.
Although they're looking for like Mercedes-Benz and BMW. They're not like stealing the Gremlin.
Yeah, you know? The Camry.
Yeah, they're not stealing the Pinto.
No.
I don't think. Nice. Yeah, it's the expensive cars that they're stealing.
Yeah. The crew establishes their base of operations at a bar, of course, called the Gemini Lounge, a local bar on Flatlands Avenue in the Canarsie area of East Brooklyn. Where else are you going to set up your headquarters?
I forget what it was before that. It's a church now.
Wow. It's basically a low-key drinking establishment secretly owned by DeMeo, with an apartment behind it rented by Guglielmo.
I got to tell you this. When I'm watching these docs, a lot of times they do it from the cop point of view, you know, because they don't have a lot of gangsters that are doing this.
Willing, yeah.
But there's nothing more macho than a 1970s cop, you know what I mean? So I'm going to try to do this. He goes, now, the Gemini Lounge was a watering hole. It was a place where a guy could have a drink after work. Not a disco. No, a quiet place. The distinction being it's owned by DeMeo, so people are getting killed there. I'm just like,
it's like the bar Nicholson owned in The Departed. Just killed guys in the back room.
Yeah. Huh. Oh, that's got to be, you know, like taken straight from this.
Yeah, yeah. In 1973, Roy DeMeo has become one of the Gambino family's top earners. He's only 32 years old. This is the same year that DeMeo will discover yet another lucrative line of work. A business associate by the name of Paul Rothenberg finds himself in some legal trouble. Rothenberg is an illegal pornography distributor who has long been extorted by the Gambino family via the DeMeo crew. When Rothenberg's film processing studio is raided by law enforcement, they discover payments made to DeMeo. Roy and company become concerned that he can be leveraged to reveal their entire operation. Gaggi orders the hit on Porno Paul, and DeMeo is given the job. Roy summons Rothenberg to a meeting at a local restaurant. He reportedly tails his target to a nearby alley. Here, he stops Rothenberg and gives him two shots to the head with a .38 caliber pistol equipped with a silencer.
So Rothenberg was left sprawled out in the alley and was eventually discovered by just a passerby. That film raid reportedly had over $500,000 seized, which is about $3 million today.
Wow.
So it's big business, you know. And by all reports, this is DeMeo's first kill, but it apparently woke some kind of demon within him because murder comes really easy to him from now on.
I mean, if your nickname is Porno Paul, you're not living... It's one of the greatest nicknames I've heard so far, but you're not living a long, healthy life.
Full disclosure, that's a nickname I gave him. Nobody called him that.
Porno Paul. I love it. It fits so well.
It does.
It fits him perfect.
Rolls off the tongue, nice. Porno Paul.
It's my gift to him post-mortem.
You're welcome, Paul.
Late 1974, a conflict of volcanic consequences brews between Roy DeMeo and Andre Katz. Katz has been picked up on a narcotics charge and is facing some time in prison if convicted. Law enforcement is far more interested in what the car thief can tell them about his criminal associates, namely Chris Harvey Rosenberg. Obviously, Rosenberg could potentially lead them to DeMeo. It's a chance he's unwilling to take. Upon being informed that Katz may be cooperating with authorities in their pursuit of DeMeo and his crew, Gaggi again gives the order to take the trash out. In June of 1975, the unsuspecting Katz is lured to a confrontation.
So basically, Katz views himself as a ladies' man. Maybe he is, I don't know. But all they do is Rosenberg knows this girl. She seems like she just calls Katz for a date. You know, like, hi, I'm a girl, you want to come over? He's like, yeah, I'll be right there.
It seems like looking back at it, it seems like a great method. I'm surprised this wouldn't have been used more often. Like some of these like sleazy guys that are starting to get money from being with the mob now, like set up some fake date and they'll be there and as fast as they humanly can.
Well, yeah, there's actually a problem with that. I had a buddy a long time ago that got busted for cocaine dealing, and he was not a cocaine dealer. He was at like a Lee's Inn bar or something. This hot girl came up, starts dancing with him, asking him if he can find some coke. He would have found coke.
I'll be right back.
Yeah, he would have found like
a... Let me call somebody.
Would have found Egyptian AK-47s if that's what it took to seal the deal.
He's in a phone booth, like flipping through a Yellow Pages. Yeah, who could I call?
Broke his neck to make that deal happen for her and ends up getting 2 years.
It's the easiest way to get to him. A pretty girl.
Be aware.
On the disco floor.
So anyway, this is how it goes down, and he drives across town like a sucker and right into his death.
Instead of finding a woman, Andre Katz finds the DeMeo crew waiting for him. Allegedly, the men throw a noose around the neck of the Randy snitch, blindfold him, and throw him in the trunk of their car. Katz is then taken to a butcher shop called the Pantry Pride Meat Market in Queens. He's secured to a chair in the building, which is basically a slaughterhouse. Roy DeMeo's time spent as a butcher's apprentice is about to pay off. DeMeo stabs Katz repeatedly until he's dead. He then takes to dismembering his body with the meat processing tools and wrapping the individual parts into neat little paper packages. The separated pieces are then discarded into the fat collection dumpster outside the establishment.
It's actually not a terrible plan. If the garbage truck collects the discarded fat dumpster, it'll take it to a special part of the landfill. And because of the nature of the rotting meat, the waste is covered almost immediately with a big layer of dirt, right? So the pieces would be impossible to find, even with cadaver dogs. Apparently the dogs are trained to sniff dead protein, and the whole field is dead protein.
Mm, yeah.
So the problem in this scenario is that the trash pickup didn't come until after the weekend. So some homeless guy goes rooting around in the trash and discovers what he thinks is a fresh leg of lamb. Right, he figures he's got a good score until he notices the leg of a lamb has a tattoo. So this, of course, freaks him out, and he brings a ton of cops. And a forensic pathologist is a young girl who apparently the grisly sight of this sickens her almost to the point of fainting. I'm not big on leg of lamb, but I gotta think there's a world of difference between that and Katz's big-ass hairy leg.
I was gonna say... I wonder how many bites it took him to realize.
Yeah, how hungry... Do you think he took a chance? He was like, I'm kind of hungry.
Wait a sec. Unless he... Maybe he wasn't a hairy guy. I don't know. He strikes me as a hairy guy.
I'm thinking everybody we talk about in this is a hairy guy.
that's a safe bet to make.
Yeah. Once Katz is identified, it's generally known that he has mob connections. This actually works to DeMeo's benefit. Police resources are always limited. When a criminal comes up dead, there is not a lot of interest in the way of public outcry. To add to the disinterest, there is little in the way of forensic evidence and zero witnesses. A few detectives, however, privately wonder if there aren't more people disposed of in this manner that have yet to be discovered. For the time being, the DeMeo crew has gotten away with a very public murder. Riding on the success of the Andre Katz elimination, the DeMeo crew refines what will become known as the Gemini Method. Their victims are lured into the back apartment rented by DeMeo crew member Joseph Dracula Guglielmo. The small flat has been modified into a makeshift slaughterhouse. The target is presumably made at ease, perhaps sitting at a small table in the kitchen. He's suddenly surprised by an abrupt gunshot to the head, and someone would quickly wrap a towel around the gaping wound to contain the mess. From there, other members would pierce the heart with a knife or ice pick to stop the flow of blood pumping immediately. Now the real work begins. A couple of guys clad only in their underwear drag the body to the bathroom and into the shower.
Relax, it's just a murder.
The body is hung upside down from a presumably professionally installed shower rod, and its throat is cut to allow the body to be drained of its blood. Once the blood is completely drained or congealed, the corpse is wrapped in a swimming pool liner and moved to the living room.
You know, it's just a man in me, but like as soon as I heard this, I'm like, who the hell hung that rod?
Yeah.
Because you know, I can barely hang the curtain up in my bathroom and the thing's coming down.
Yeah.
They're like draining a body from it. And apparently the body drains for 45 minutes. I heard that in more than one place. Not 44, not 46. 45 minutes.
45. Gotta be precise.
Yeah, I was like, there must be like some kind of recipe because I heard 45 minutes in multiple places.
I'm sure you do it enough. They probably got bored and timed it.
Yeah.
Just to see, get everything more down to a science.
Yeah, well, we got that from the mathematician.
Here, the body is dismembered. Arms are cut at the elbow. Not an easy job. Legs at the knee. The head pops off quite easily, and only the torso remains. The disassembled parts are placed in individual boxes for easy transport, and then it's off to the Brooklyn Fountain Avenue dump. The dump, as luck would have it, is owned primarily by corrupt Italians, so not a lot of questions will be asked. It's hard work, and the guys often take a pizza break halfway through, but in the end they have themselves a murder system ready for mass production. Mass production is exactly what Roy DeMeo has in mind.
I wonder if the Gemini Lounge sells food.
Bet they have some killer wings, right?
You can always count on the wings.
You can always count on the wings at a bar.
They have chicken fingers. Hold the chicken.
In the vein of Murder, Inc., the DeMeo crew got into the business of killing. Going far beyond the necessity of killing for his own business interests, he began to provide murder as a service to the other crime families of New York. If someone in the Lucchese family, for instance, has an interorganizational problem with another family member, he could simply go to Roy. Problem solved. He's also reputed to specialize in the disposal of bodies, in case you have a pre-killed body you need help discarding.
He didn't kill everybody at the Gemini, but that was his preferred method. And he would just invite people over for a party or something. That part's a little confusing to me because it's like, is he such a great guy that everybody just comes over, you know? And they take him to the apartment in the
back. Go to Roy's place.
Yeah, I'd be like, what the hell? No, I don't want to go to the Gemini. There's nothing going on at the Gemini, you know? So, but anyway, like sometimes they'd have to get him like other places, like a parking lot, or they said once on a yacht would take him out and stuff. And but the Gemini was the perfect contained place, you know? And a lot of the cops thought like the dismembering was unnecessary and that he's just a psycho and stuff. But I kind of disagree because he's like, well, he could have just plugged him in the head and dumped him in the ocean. You know, I'm like, there's a lot of shit that could go wrong taking an entire body into a car, out to the water, onto the boat. Yeah. And when you're talking about the numbers these guys are doing, it seems like I don't know that they did it because they're all psychos.
And plus at the dump, they know the guys running the place. They can just get in and get out easy.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing that doesn't lend credence to that theory is that Gaji's nephew, who's that Dominic Montiglio, he said he visited there a lot. He was kind of like a pickup man, and he passed messages back and forth and stuff. He said that the guys seemed depressed if they didn't kill somebody at least once every 3 weeks. Like, the guys would get kind of down.
Got to boost morale.
Right. But that doesn't mean they like chopping them up. You know what I mean? But they just like, I think they like killing people, but who knows?
A precarious subject for the DeMeo crew was the distribution of narcotics. The Gambino family, and most of the others at this time, were officially against drug dealing, wary of the law enforcement heat it tended to bring. It was further assumed that anyone caught dealing would be more likely to become an informant in order to escape the harsh penalties that were being levied on such crimes. Violating the drug dealing rule was technically punishable by death. Despite these dire consequences, Gaji and DeMeo were heavily into the drug trade. The enormous profits were too much to pass up. By the mid-70s, Roy is dealing cocaine out of the Gemini Lounge. He's also invested in a large Colombian marijuana operation that regularly imports 25-pound bales to be distributed from a Canarsie body shop. DeMeo kicks a tribute up to Gaji, of course, and Gaji pretends not to know where the extra cash is coming from. Around the end of 1975, Roy DeMeo has a brief dust-up with the IRS, due largely to his connection to the failed credit union fiasco. As the defunct credit union eventually merges with another, the feds begin to question DeMeo's involvement and the source of his excessive wealth. DeMeo dances away from the charges, having quit the bank before its downfall. He also calls upon his friends and associates to provide false affidavits that name him as a legitimate employee with varying sources of income. It's enough to get them off his back.
I could just hear him talking to the feds. He goes, you know, I left that place. I just had a bad feeling that it wasn't being run right. Frankly, between you and me, I think some shady things might have been going on there.
Things get a little complicated in mid-1976 when a made man in the Lucchese family named Joseph Brocchini engages Roy in an argument. The conflict has something to do with their mutual interest in a pornography racket. Having the upper hand as an officially made man, Brocchini takes the liberty of punching DeMeo square in the face, giving him a nice shiner for his troubles. As he's only an associate, Roy has little options at the moment, but later has a little sit-down with his mentor Gaji, and allegedly Gaji's nephew Dominic Montiglio. Obviously, Roy DeMeo has plans for Brocchini. Nino reminds him that the rules dictate that he not, under any circumstances, take action against a made man. The implication is clear. Don't get caught. On May 20th, 1976, Brocchini is working in the office of a used car dealership he owns. He is apparently distracted as Roy DeMeo and Henry Borelli quickly and quietly enter the building. They subdue the employees at gunpoint, blindfolding and handcuffing them under the guise of a robbery. They then repay Brucelli's ill-considered punch in the face with 5 shots in the back of his head. They ransack the office for good measure and make their escape. Ransacking just for like...
They're making it look like a robbery. Because he's a made guy. He can't take he can't take the heat for that. So it's like, hey, somebody came in and robbed the place.
Pretty smart.
All you need is plausible deniability when you're bringing in millions of dollars.
Yeah. At this point, it might behoove the DeMeo crew to lay low for a while, but it's not their style. The following month saw the murder of Vincent Govanera, Governor apparently had no crime ties whatsoever, but did have the misfortune of engaging in a physical altercation with Nino Gaji a couple years prior. Gaji was not one to forgive a transgression, and had always kept an eye out for Governor. His nephew finally spotted him at a craps game in a New York neighborhood, alerted his uncle, and even left his own wife's birthday party to pursue poor Vincent. Roy, Gaji, and Dominic waited by Governor's car, and as he approached the three men unsuspecting, was shot several times and left for dead. He managed to survive about a week, but eventually succumbed to his wounds.
Like, he left his wife's birthday party to go kill the guy. I can see him. He pulls a gun on him. He still has the birthday hat and the little thing in his mouth.
I see where you're going with that.
Yeah.
They're all looking badass in the parking lot, but he's got Tony, the Coney party hat on. They're like, take that thing off.
That's good. Seems that Gaji's revenge list was not a short one. A man named George Byram made the cut by feeding information to a burglary team that resulted in the sacking of Nino's own house. This act of insanity was answered by flying DeMeo to Florida. Once in the Sunshine State, he met with Gaji and Anthony Plotty, a Gambino soldier operating in Florida. Roy lured Byram to a hotel room under the pretense of a new business arrangement and immediately shot him to death as he walked into the room. The plan was to dismember him and carry him out in a few suitcases, but something apparently went wrong as he was later found in the hotel bathroom with his head cut halfway off. In the fall of 1976, the Gambino family goes through a massive change when its boss, Carlo Gambino, dies of natural causes. Paul Castellano is named the new boss. This is good news for Roy DeMeo. His mentor Nino is bumped up to the position of capo, taking over the crew of men Castellano ran. This promotion is beneficial for Roy, whose friend and boss is now even closer to the ruling Gambino hierarchy. It is further speculated that the death of Carlo Gambino will eventually open up the family for new memberships. These speculations eventually lead to frustrations, as Paul Castellano is not excited about bringing Roy DeMeo into the Gambino hierarchy. Castellano considers himself to be more of a white-collar criminal, and the thuggish antics of the DeMeo crew, while beneficial, are not something he wants to associate with his organization in an official capacity. Gaji tries unsuccessfully to persuade his boss, and as 1977 ticks away, Roy DeMeo is still not gotten his button. Angry but undeterred, DeMeo commits to making even more money for the Gambino family until they have no choice but to acknowledge him. DeMeo finds his new cash source in a gang of Irish-American criminals known as the Westies, headed by a famed gangster named Mickey Spillane.
So in the 1970s, the Irish mob was banging heads with the Italians, specifically the Genovese family, over a construction project called the Jacob K. Javits Convention Center. Now, the convention center is located in Spillane's Hell's Kitchen neighborhood. Spillane refuses to allow any involvement by Italians. He somehow manages to hold them off. Now, this has been going on for a while. It's a big embarrassment to the Italian families. So this is kind of setting up DeMeo to make a bridge here, right? So the Italians are frustrated, they're embarrassed. They respond by hiring a rogue Irish-American hitman named Joseph Mad Dog Sullivan to assassinate three of Spillane's top lieutenants. The situation's tense, to say the least, when it comes to Roy DeMeo coming in.
Obviously, Mickey Spillane is not going to greet DeMeo with open arms, so he needs to find another inn. His opportunity comes in the form of James Coonan, who has been in a long-standing war with Spillane since he was 18 years old. Coonan makes an agreement with DeMeo that if the Spillane problem is to disappear, he will take over the family and basically become an extension of the Gambino interest.
So Coonan's got this long-standing beef with Spillane. Without getting too much into the Irish mob part of it, at one point at a very young age, Coonan stands on a building and fires a Tommy gun down onto Spillane and these guys. And he doesn't really hurt anybody, but they realize that he's somebody they got to look out for. And Spillane, he retaliates by finding Coonan's dad and pistol whips him and kidnaps him and tries to figure out where the son is and stuff. So there's this beef going on. So this is the end for DeMeo. If he can get rid of Spillane and put this guy in, and this guy's got a following going, so there's a civil war thing going on, and this is his big chance to get things taken care of.
In May 1977, Roy and Edward Grillo murder Spillane as agreed, making Jimmy the top criminal figure in the West Side. Roy, sensing an opportunity to create a vast source of income for his superiors, informs Anthony Gaggi of the possibilities of a partnership between the Westies and the Gambino family. Shortly afterwards, Coonan and his second-in-command, Mickey Featherstone, are called to a meeting with Paul Castellano, and they do, in fact, become a de facto arm of the Gambino crime family and agree to share 10% of all profits. Mickey Featherstone. That'd be a good, like, boxing name. Mickey Featherstone. In exchange, the Westies will acquire several lucrative union deals and take on murder contracts for the Italians.
And just to be clear, the Westies are into the exact same kind of shit that DeMeo's into. He's loan sharking, gambling.
Porn.
Maybe porn, prostitution. But they're doing that on the West Side. So they become an extension of the Gambino family.
It's impossible to ignore that Roy DeMeo plays a crucial role in securing the Westie-Gambino alliance. This finally convinces Castellano to give Roy his button, or formally induct him into the Gambino crime family. DeMeo is made in mid-1977 and is put in charge of handling all family business with the Westies. He's also ordered to get permission before committing any murders and to avoid drug dealing. Despite this warning, DeMeo's crew continues to sell large amounts of cocaine, marijuana, and a variety of narcotic pills, an infraction committed by many mobsters at this time. The money is just too alluring.
So obviously, I think most of us know, when you get made, they basically take you down to a basement. They burn a card with a saint on it, and you swear your oath and stuff. And then there's a big party afterward. DeMeo offered to bring the cold cuts to the party, but that was declined.
It's not just the narcotic rule that the DeMeo crew has trouble with. They continue to commit unsanctioned killings as well. In July 1977, Roy and his men indulged themselves in a double homicide, shooting to death Jonathan Quinn, a successful car thief suspected of cooperating with law enforcement, and Sherry Golden, Quinn's 19-year-old girlfriend.
So the murder of these two take place in Brooklyn. Quinn's actually a friend of Nino Gaggi's, but when he becomes a rat, Roy DeMeo finds out. He tells Gaggi. So they call him for a sit-down at their hangout, and sadly, Quinn comes with his 19-year-old girlfriend. She stays in the car, and he's killed the second he enters the club. While the crew's in there cutting up the body parts, two jokers go up and they're chatting up the girl. And then as soon as they're done and ready, eventually they shoot her and they leave her body in the car.
Roy has called you for a meeting and you're like, "Hey, honey, do you want to join me?
I
gotta
Roy?
Go. I gotta go do something real quick." Why would you invite her?
If he shows up with a witness, can't you just do it later? Now, what if he'd have taken the bus? Do you gotta kill everybody on the bus?
I gotta kill a lot of people tonight. Cut the brakes, just have it sitting out there.
Then you gotta send 30 guys out there, like, "How you all doing?"
Jeez.
Everybody come out.
Come on in, let's get a look at you.
Nice orderly line.
DeMeo and his men dump the bodies in locations where they'll be discovered to serve as a warning against any other aspiring rats. You probably like that, Bill.
I do like that.
Like rats.
No, I don't like it. Change my answer.
I do like that. Yeah.
Sounds like good
idea. Hey, let me down the path there.
When questioned by Castellano as to the motive of killing a young woman, Gaggi assures him that she was a risk and may have cooperated had the police pressured her. Castellano chooses to believe it, but things are beginning to go south for the DeMeo crew. Next problem that surfaces is a heavy debt that is mounting by crew member Edward Grillo. The substantial weight of the debt worried DeMeo and Gaggi, as they felt it might make him susceptible to police coercion. Rather than simply forgiving the debt, they send him through the human meat machine like so many before him. It is the first time that the crew has processed one of their own. Now the proverbial shit hits the fan, as problems arise with one of Roy's favorite crew members, Chris Rosenberg.
This always reminds me of something you said about the mob movies. Like, it goes to this crescendo where he's just on top and then everything falls to shit.
That's what's so exciting about him, is that there usually is a guy coming from nothing or humble beginnings, becomes incredibly wealthy, powerful, well-liked, unstoppable, and then
to see it.
Almost like taking like the floor from under him. They don't even realize it sometimes, and then it's like the hole's too deep.
Rosenberg travels to Florida to establish a large cocaine deal. he is to meet up with three Cuban frontmen, who are middlemen for the Colombian cartel. Booking himself into a hotel under the assumed name of Chris DeMeo, he meets the Cubans and discusses business. Misunderstanding the politics of this undertaking, Rosenberg figures to sweeten his deal by eliminating the middlemen. He figures by killing the Cubans, he can deal directly with the Colombian cartel and save a little money. Under the pretense of traveling with the three men back to New York City, Rosenberg kills his contact, his son, and his brother-in-law. When he gets back to New York and shares his adventure with Roy DeMeo, his boss is in a complete state of shock and disbelief.
So DeMeo can't believe this guy just messed with the Colombian cartel, and he's basically provoking a war between the Colombians and the Gambino family. So just trying to wrap his head around what kind of crap Chris has gotten him into, he's like, what name did you use? And he finds out that he used his name. So his disbelief turns into just sheer dread and panic. I'd be like, hey, I robbed the place, but don't worry. I told them I was Zach Griffin.
Oh, good. Thanks. Great. Great.
This is my theory on how everything happens from here on out. There's a chance that while they're dealing all this cocaine that they're using some of their product.
Oh, yeah.
Because their behavior is becoming so erratic.
This is a solid chance.
Yeah. And it's like, these guys went from being really smart, calculating, efficient guys to everybody's a freaking idiot bungler now.
Yeah. I mean, well, that seems like a coked up plan. Well, if I just kill these three guys, then it's just me and the Colombians hanging out.
It's astounding.
Definitely was like, in the morning he was good, had a little bit of the product, and then by the afternoon when the meeting came about, he was like, I could just take them out and it's all for me.
And they're probably dealing so much coke, they won't notice if they take a little bit.
And you check into the hotel as Chris DeMeo.
He won't mind, right?
She's like,
why?
In your name, sir? He's like, think of a lie, think of a lie, think of a lie. DeMeo!
Like, you could literally use any name.
The only thing that would have been worse is Gambino.
Yeah, exactly. What happened to Smith, Jones, Johnson?
Literally any name would have worked besides your boss.
The Gambinos reach out to the Colombians to explain the misunderstanding, and it's decided that the only way to make things right is to kill Chris Rosenberg as a gesture of goodwill. Roy is given the job of cleaning up the mess that is his most loyal crew member. He reportedly stalls for weeks.
Speaking of mathematician, I'm no Colombian drug lord, but I can count to three. You killed three of my guys. So how is killing Chris going to be enough? I'd want Chris and two of his family members.
Yeah.
And not the mother-in-law that he hates. It's got to be two people he likes.
It's during this time that things go from very bad to much worse. On April 19th, 1979, an innocent college student named Dominic Rigucci is working his job as a door-to-door vacuum salesman. He has the misfortune of being parked outside of DeMeo's house when the mobster is returning home. Roy sees the kid parked in front of his house and believes him to be a Colombian hitman. He immediately calls Freddy DeNome and Joseph Guglielmo for backup, and the three mobsters throw the struggling college student into a high-speed chase for his life. Naturally, speedster DeNome is at the wheel, while DeMeo and Guglielmo are hanging outside the windows firing wildly at Rigucci. He was literally pleading for his life. Student's car becomes so damaged by bullets that it's rendered undrivable, and he's shot to death by the DeMeo assassins. Believing he has killed a Colombian assassin, Roy gathers his family and goes on the lam outside of New York for a short time.
So eventually the whole thing hits the media cycle, and Albert is Roy's son. He tells a lot of stories about this kind of time period and stuff. But he said he was there when his dad saw on TV that it was an innocent college kid that she got shot. And according to him, Roy burst into tears and was just distraught when this happened. That crying little bitch. The poor Gooch.
The accidental murder of the college student has Nino Gaggi starting to regret his relationship with DeMeo, who is possibly starting to become more trouble than he's worth. DeMeo still hasn't killed Rosenberg, who is partially to blame for this whole mess from a certain point of view. Yeah, he's to blame. he's to blame. Gaggi orders DeMeo to get the execution over with before there are any other accidents.
They're all sitting around a table, and Rosenberg goes, "You know, I can't help but feel partially responsible for this. Sometimes I think if I hadn't killed those Colombians,
maybe this would be different."
In May 1979, Rosenberg, who seemingly has no knowledge of the Colombian agreement, arrives at a meeting of the DeMeo crew and is shot in the head by Roy. Somehow, he manages to get to his feet even as the blood gushes from his skull. Crew member Anthony Center then finishes Rosenberg off as he senses that DeMeo is emotionally unequal to the task. Colombians have demanded that his murder make the papers as verification. Roy's men place Rosenberg's body in his car and park it on the side of Cross Bay Boulevard near Gateway National Wildlife Refuge to be found.
So to make sure that it is a media spectacle, they apparently get a modified machine gun, they put him in it, and they just riddle the car with bullets. But they're saying that there's low interest when people like a mobster dies.
Yeah.
So if the crime scene's weird enough, you know what I mean?
It'll get something going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Later testimony from DeMeo's son, Frederick DeNome and Vito Arena, indicate that Roy expressed regret at having to kill Chris and at times appeared depressed over it. For the DeMeo crew, life must go on. As 1979 comes around, they begin to expand their auto theft operation. They are making moves that will make it the largest of its kind in New York City's history. The scheme involves five partners, put together by Roy, who conspire to steal hundreds of cars and ship them internationally from New Jersey to Kuwait. The five partners are reportedly raking in 30 grand, approximately 114 grand today, per week. Of course, the actual stealing is done by crew members like Vito Arena, DeNome, and the like. Incredibly, the entire operation is almost thwarted by a legitimate car dealer who threatens to expose the crime to law enforcement. Naturally, he is killed, along with an uninvolved companion, before he ever gets close to reporting the crime. Just when it seems like things are finally back on track, there is more trouble on the horizon. This time it comes in the form of two fellow Gambino family members named James Eppolito and James Eppolito Jr.
So these two are maid guys. They're the relatives of a well-known corrupt NYPD detective, and they also have a brother that's a maid guy in the Gambino family. So these two guys, when they come to Castellano, they're not without their clout.
Disgruntled Eppolito boys meet with Paul Castellano and levy outrageous allegations of narcotics trafficking on the part of Gaggi and DeMeo. They remind their boss that the punishment for this infraction is death. Always the arbitrator of blind justice, Castellano weighs the evidence at hand and exonerates his friend Gaggi. He further gives Gaggi the nod to deal with these two crybabies however he sees fit. On October 1st, 1979, Gaggi and DeMeo somehow manage to get themselves into Eppolito Jr.'s 1978 Ford Thunderbird and hitch a ride to the Gemini Club. At some point, Eppolito Sr. gets a funny feeling that this is no ordinary joyride, but it's too late. In the parked car, Gaggi and DeMeo open fire on the snitches, cracking the windows just a bit beforehand to prevent from rupturing their eardrums from the sound of gun blasts. Murphy's Law kicks into high gear as a taxi car driven by an off-duty police officer hears the shots and gives chase to the mobsters. In the end, DeMeo evades capture, but Gaggi is arrested after being shot in the neck. Roy is never identified by witnesses, but Anthony Gaggi faces charges of murder and the attempted murder of the arresting officer. He ends up corrupting the jury and gets the lesser charge of assault, which lands him 5 to 15 years in federal prison. It turns out to be an exercise in futility, as DeMeo murders the sole witness shortly after Gaggi's sentencing hearing in March of 1980. The massive Kuwaiti car theft operation, now dubbed the Empire Boulevard Operation by law enforcement, expands through 1979 to 1980 until the warehouse that serves as the headquarters is raided by the FBI that following summer. The feds had seen the unloading of vehicles there and had obtained a search warrant. Henry Borelli and Frederick DeNome are arrested in May 1981 for their roles in the operation, but there is not enough evidence to arrest any of the other active partners. Roy orders Borelli and Denome to plead guilty to the charges in hopes that it will stop any further investigations into his activities by the FBI or other law enforcement agencies.
So that's wishful thinking. By now, this is a huge international case, and it seems everyone in law enforcement wants a piece of this pie. And I really haven't told this story much by the cop point of view, but all along, there is police that are looking into different parts of this. Like, the car theft is out of control, so there's these guys, right? And then there's the murder guys, and they're starting to look at the homicides and stuff. So in the background, over the years that we're covering, these guys are getting together, they're starting to compare notes, and they're putting this all together. And like, when this car thing happens, they're like, holy shit, they never even imagined that a car theft operation could be this sophisticated. And on the flip side, the homicide division is starting to realize they never imagined that it could be this sophisticated. But they're about to find out it's just the tip of the iceberg.
A bigger problem is a couple of ex-gang members named Vito Arena and Joseph Lee. Vito and Joseph were stick-up guys by trade, but learned the art of car theft in the DeMeo gang. The problem with these two was that they were also a homosexual couple in a world that was less than culturally enlightened at the time. Open about their sexuality, the two became the targets of aggression in the DeMeo gang. Soon they were fearful that they'd be killed merely for sport, and they decided to return to their carefree days of armed robbery, free from the persecution of homophobic gangsters.
So the problem with these two is that they get busted in a stick-up after they leave the gang, and Arena decides to talk about the DeMeo crew, and he didn't even want much of a deal. All he wants to do is be locked up with his boyfriend. Like, he doesn't ask for, you know, money. He doesn't ask for any leniency, any immunity, right? So they're just like, well, hell yeah. And they go and they get this detective in, and it's like a Sunday night, right? So they're like, you got some dirt on DeMeo? He goes, yeah, they're killing people over there. They're chopping them up. And they're like, what? He goes, yeah, we chop them up. But he starts telling them how this shit goes down, you know? Their jaws are hitting the floor. They had no idea. And he's like telling them, like, yeah, you know, the head comes right off. It's no problem. And it's, I've seen pictures of this guy, though. He's huge. Like, think Pussy Bompensero. So, like, so when you're hearing about these guys, they're not some wispy little guys. You know, they're big dudes. And he's just giving it out, right? And I actually found out that Sopranos, Vito, that whole scenario.
Based on this.
Yeah. Vito, the guy who plays him, said, yeah, we decided to take this and kind of apply it to the storyline.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's the same kind of deal, because that guy was no pushover, you know? So that's kind of where this is going. And he tells him about this one guy in particular, Joseph Scorny. He's like, we killed him and we shoved him in a barrel, but he wouldn't fit in the barrel. So we had to take a shovel and we just popped his head off. And then we could put his head down in the barrel with him. We filled it with concrete and we dumped it off a boat. But he's like, so we dumped him off into the water. So he shows them where it is. They get a scuba team out there with the cops and everything. And they say the scuba guy comes up in about 10 minutes. It was 3 years ago that they dumped this body, right? The scuba guy comes up and goes, it's like 20 barrels down here. So they're like, well, it's the one you can't move because it's full of concrete. So they start shaking them and everything. And apparently it's not welded shut. They just use that snap ring kind of thing, is the impression I get, because it leaked. And they said over time the salt water just dissipated the concrete anyway. So they pour this guy out. Of course, he's bones.
Yeah.
But they still got his dungaree jacket, his wallet, everything. It's Scorny. And so now the shit's hitting the fan.
As 1982 unfolds, the FBI is finally realizing the incredible number of people that go into the Gemini Lounge and never come out. Paul Castellano is ready to cut his losses. He's put out a hit on Roy DeMeo, but is having a hard time finding someone to do the job. It's rumored that even John Gotti doesn't want the job, as DeMeo has an army of killers at his disposal. Allegedly, the job is finally given to Gambino underboss Frank DeCisso, but he and his men find themselves unable to get close enough to pull it off. It's been speculated that the hit is eventually carried out by two of Roy's own men.
I read somewhere that Gotti had actually said he'd only killed maybe 10 or 12 men at that time to DeMeo's hundreds.
Yeah. In his last days, Roy is said to have been seen on the streets, heavily armed, and paranoid as hell.
So I saw one of the docs that featured a detective talking about this whole time period. And what they decide to do is to approach him. And there's accounts where he's walking around all paranoid. Again, I feel like he's coked up. You know, every description of him sounds like a coked up, jacked up guy. But he's got this big leather coat on. He's carrying a shotgun around. You know, he's looking all around and stuff. So the cop goes and he tells him that he knows what's going on. You know, and he's like, here's your chance. And the DeMeo immediately tries to bribe him. And he's like, you're an old guy. Why do you want to mess with this stuff, man? Tell you what, how about I give you $1 million, Swiss bank account. You forget this thing. All I need is the name of the informant. Who's telling you this shit? And the cop's basically like, you know what? I just assume pull you out of the trunk of your car. But this is the chance to save your life. The male's like, nah, I'm a soldier. And you remember, he wanted to do this his whole life.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm a mob soldier and I'm going to die a mob soldier. If they're going to kill me, then it's my time. But he's not going to be a rat, you know, and he makes it very clear.
Kind of honorable.
Yeah. So anyway, it's Albert DeMeo tells a lot about his final days. And then he said he actually...
DeMeo was his son.
That's his son, yeah. And he said he considered faking his death and leaving the country, which probably wouldn't have been a bad idea.
No.
But instead he leaves the house one day and just never comes back. And Albert says he found his personal belongings, like his watch, his wallet, his ring. He left all those in the study room with a religious pamphlet that like indicated that he went to confession one last time. So when he left the house, he was going knowing, it seems like, that he was going to be killed.
Well, if he wanted to leave the country, he could have gone to Kuwait. Had connections there. Could have worked out, maybe.
He could have hidden the trunk of the car. He's going to end up there anyway.
According to Anthony Casso's 2008 biography, Roy DeMeo is killed at Patrick Testa's East Flatbush home by Joseph Testa and Anthony Center, following an agreement with Casso, who was given the contract by Gotti and DeCisso after they were unable to kill DeMeo during the fall of 1982. The Casso biography notes that DeMeo was seated, about to receive coffee, when Testa and Center opened fire. Anthony Gaggi was not present. A few days later, on January 18th, Roy DeMeo is found murdered in his abandoned car's trunk. He has been shot multiple times in the head and has a bullet wound in his hand, assumed by law enforcement as being from throwing his hand up to his face in a self-defense reflex when the shots were fired at him. Anthony Gaggi is suspected by law enforcement officials of being the one who personally killed DeMeo, although it is likely crew members Joseph Testa and Anthony Center were present as well.
The cop who offered the informant the deal is the one that pulls him from the trunk. According to the legend, he when they find the body, he's like, don't open the trunk. I want to be the one to pull him out because I told him I'd pull his ass out of the trunk. So that's the typical 70s cop thing. You know, I want to live up to that.
Yeah.
So he's the one that pulls him out. Yeah, he was frozen. It was the temperature dropped. He'd been in there about 4 days. So he's actually in the car, shot up, in a fetal position, and he's frozen, stuck to a chandelier that he was supposed to get repaired. And now it's like frozen to his body. And that's how they find him.
Well, what was wrong with the chandelier? That's my question.
Probably a wiring issue.
There's something wrong with it now.
Yeah.
There's a dead guy frozen to it. In April 1984, Colombo crime family soldier Ralph Scopo is overheard explaining to an associate that DeMeo had been killed by his own family because they merely suspected that he wouldn't be able to stand up to legal charges that resulted from his stolen car ring. The motive, as suggested by Scopo, is widely accepted by law enforcement and other sources. Another reason was that DeMeo was attracting too much attention from the FBI. DeMeo's crew is soon rounded up, and the core members Henry Borelli, Joseph Testa, and Anthony Center are imprisoned for life after two trials that see them convicted of a collective total of 25 murders in addition to extortion. Gaggi is never charged with the crime, although he is charged with a number of other murders. He dies of a heart attack during his trial in 1988 at age 62. Paul Castellano was indicted for ordering the murder of DeMeo, as well as a host of other crimes, but is killed in December 1985 while out on bail in the middle of his first trial. The murder is ordered by John Gotti, who thus becomes the new boss of the Gambino family. This concludes the legend of Roy Albert DeMeo.
See, I was talking to some guys on Instagram about this because I just posted a picture of DeMeo and said we were getting ready for it and stuff. And a guy had made the point, if they'd have kept him alive. If Castellano would have kept him alive, he could have probably insulated himself from his own assassination. You know, because Gotti was unstoppable at this point.
Yeah.
But he's like, DeMeo crew would have stopped Gotti.
Right. Yeah, they would have.
Like, yeah. He's like, yeah, if he'd have just wrote it out, you know, this would have been okay. And also, they're killing people left and right because they think he's going to turn informant. I see nothing in DeMeo that says he's going to rat.
No.
Nothing.
It's like that story you told about the biography and stuff. No way.
Nah, I mean, he's been dreaming about being made
in
the mafia, and he finally has it.
Yeah.
He's not going to go to be an informant.
No.
No, but like, nowadays, like, everyone... Kid Twist, like, he was violent, and as soon as it came to him getting in trouble, he just, like, squealed. Yeah. Like, you never saw it in him, but he's still...
Yeah, and this is everybody's ratting at this point. Everybody they're picking up, all the car thieves, everybody is ratting. But I just, you never know, but I think DeMeo is a different cat.
Especially because he chose to... just die. He's like, it's my time.
I'm right.
Like, taking any handout at all. No. That'd be the time to rat or to give any information up.
Try to get some kind of protection. He wasn't interested.
If it's my time to die, it's my time to die.
He had a good run. You know, I always thought, too, like, in my personal life, I think people with kids and families are bad partners for this kind of stuff because you'll do anything.
Right.
You'll use your kids as a justification. You know what I mean? Like, oh, either I have to protect them or I owe them a better life. And yeah, you do, but that's why you don't get into this shit. You know what I mean? But I've seen people do some really messed up stuff because, well, if I didn't have my kid, you know, but sorry, I got to rat on all you because my kid needs a father. Mm-hmm. You know? And so just in my opinion, good family men make lousy criminals.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because it's fair.
Yeah. So anyway, just to remind everybody, there's a lot of speculation about how many people he killed. Like, there's a 10-minute interview online of Michael Franchese kind of poo-pooing the whole numbers thing. And he's like, yeah, you know, I'll say I killed 200 people if I didn't, because nothing's going to happen. And if he did, he probably wouldn't admit it, and it's all bullshit, and these numbers they throw out. But it seems like a lot. I saw he killed 50 people. Then I saw he killed 75 people. Then I saw he killed 200 people. Another one said he killed 1,000 people, you know? So, and at first, when you say 200 people, it's easy to scoff and say, there's no way.
Yeah.
Okay? But for that one account, he said if every 3 weeks, they would get depressed if they weren't killing somebody, right?
Right.
So just to put it another way, like, say Zach gets a new girlfriend, right? And he just meets her, whatever. And she's a nice girl. We all like her. She's a good chick, right? She's pretty. She makes her own clothes, all that, right? Not a wild girl, right? But she's a part of our normal culture, right? And she's like, oh, no, I'm not very promiscuous. I've only had, like, maybe, what, a boyfriend every 6 months. Maybe once every 6 months. A serious date, right? Well, if she's been in the game for 10 years, that girl slept with 240 guys. You know what I mean? And that's how fast the body count adds up. You know what I mean? Now, these guys are killing people, and if there's somebody in the car, everybody in the car is getting killed.
Right.
So the numbers could easily, over a 10-year period, it ain't to a year, or it ain't to a month, you know what I'm saying, or whatever. So the numbers could easily rack up. And maybe you're not talking DeMeo personally. I would say anybody killed by the DeMeo crew, counts.
I mean, any of those numbers, it's always going to be more. It's never going to be less. If they ever say this guy killed 30 people for the mob, it'll never be, turns out he actually killed 15 people. It'll be he killed 3 times that number.
Anything triple digits and up, I would believe.
Yeah, I guess. Like I said, at first I was kind of scoffing at the numbers myself, and then I just start doing some simple math. I'm like, this could easily, add up quickly.
The mathematician, Bill Crooks.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean? And like you said, I think back in like Bugsy, like, if you, like, with Murders of Late, you see one cockroach, there are 5 or 6 underneath the desk that you don't know about.
Well, especially with these guys, because Bugsy was just leaving people laying there, you know what I mean? He didn't care. These guys, there's no evidence, you know what I mean? So what did happen after this all shakes out, they get a warrant for the Gemini, and they go in and they take the drains out, and there's blood in the drains, and they use that to identify a lot of the people. But there's so many missing people and everything. And when this whole comes out, what a horror show it was. Like, poor people are saying, like, well, my daughter came up missing and she used to hang out there and stuff. And the police are just getting flooded with calls and they can't help. You know what I mean? They just don't have the the resources to name everybody that's out. But there's a lot that are verified. And we're going to have Brett just kind of do a tribute to the victims of the DiMeo crew.
Yeah, you can find this album on Spotify, DiMeo Crew's Greatest Hits.
Paul Rothenberg, July 29th, 1973. He was shot twice in the head for suspected of cooperating with authorities. Andre Katz, June 13th, 1975. Stabbed to death and dismembered for testifying before a grand jury. Vito Borelli, mid-1975. Shot in the face and body. He made a statement on Paul Castellano's appearance in front of his daughter. Joseph Brocchini, May 20th, 1976. Shot five times in the head as a result punching DiMeo. Vincent Governaura, June 12th through the 19th, 1976. Shot multiple times as revenge for breaking Gaggi's nose in a fistfight.
That was 3 years before that.
George Byram, July 13th, 1976. Shot in the face and stabbed 11 times. He was killed for tipping off thieves that led to Nino Gaggi's vacation home in Florida being robbed. Mickey Spillane, May 13th, 1977. Shot and killed as a favor to James Coonan. Charles Ruby Stein, May 15th, 1977. Grillo shot Stein six times, dismembered by the Westie gang. Jerome Hoffaker, June 1977. Shot and killed for getting in a fight with Joseph Testa's brother. John Quinn and Cherry Golden, July 20th, 1977. Shot and killed for testifying before a grand jury. Daniel Conti, October 29th, 1977. Killed after concerns he would cooperate due to an investigation being opened into a failed hijacking attempt involving the DiMeo crew. John Costello, November 1977. Shot after concerns he would cooperate with the law. Michael Mendolino and Nino Martini. March 19th, 1978. Both were shot multiple times in the head for robbery to which Martini had no involvement. Patrick Presenzano. March 23rd, 1978. Beaten, shot and killed, then throat slit from ear to ear after refusing to return stolen jewelry from an associate of Roy DiMeo. Kevin Guilley. June 9th, 1978. Shot and killed after he attempted to scam Chris Rosenberg out of $10,000. Michael DiCarlo, May 16th, 1978. Was shot, stabbed, and beaten for raping a young boy.
I'm fine with that.
You're fine with raping a young boy?
No.
Zach, come on.
Come on, man.
Joseph Scorny.
Damn it.
September 28th, 1978. Shot and bludgeoned with a sledgehammer after refusal to join DiMeo's auto theft operation.
Bludgeoned.
Danny Grillo, November 14th, 1978. Killed and dismembered for racking up gambling debts and acquiring drug addiction. For becoming a drug addict. That's not going to help the addiction.
It's an intervention.
Yeah. Gary Gardine, November 30th, 1978. Shot and killed after he failed to pay back a marijuana deal. Peter Waring, February 7, 1979. Shot, stabbed, and dismembered for being a suspected informant. Scott Cafaro, February to March 1979. Shot multiple times for rape. Fred Todaro, February 19, 1979. Shot and stabbed due to dispute over the building in which they duplicated pornographic films. Classic dispute. Charles Pednick, William Serrano, and two unnamed. March 17th, 1979.
Two unnamed.
Yeah, the bodies weren't able to be identified.
Yeah. Shot and killed during 12-kilo cocaine deal. Jamie Pednick, March 19th, 1979. Shot and killed and dismembered after he traveled to New York to investigate his father's disappearance. That seems like an honorable thing to do.
You're not going
to
find your father.
Dominic Ragucci, April 19th, 1979. Shot seven times, mistaken for a Cuban hitman. That one's still tough.
Rest in peace.
Tough. Chris Rosenberg, May 11th, 1979. Shot and killed to avoid a war with the Cuban drug cartels. James Eppolito and Eppolito Jr., October 1st, 1979. Both of them were shot in the back of the head after they were implicated, DeMio and Gaji, in narcotics involvement. Khaled Dud and Ronald Falcaro, October 12, 1979. Shot, killed, and dismembered for being competitor of stolen car ring and suspected of cooperating with law enforcement. Joseph Coppolino, March 7, 1980. Stabbed and decapitated after suspected of implicating DeMio to a law enforcement. Patrick Penny, May 12, 1980. Shot 9 times in the head after he testified against Nino Gaji. Charles Mongatori and Daniel Scutaro, June 5th, 1980. Shot 14 times, then slit his throat after he refused to drop an assault charge. Frank Amato, September 20th, 1980. Shot and killed after hitting Castellano's pregnant daughter. James Bennett, April 29th, 1981. Shot twice in the head. He was set to testify against the DeMio crew member. Joseph Vigiano, December 4th, 1981. Shot, killed, and dismembered. He owed some money. Paul and Al Vigiano, December 21st, 1981. Shot to death after investigating the disappearance of Joseph. John and Anthony Romano, July 4th, 1982. Shot and killed for setting up the DeMio crew member for robbery in 1978.
You know they were probably trashed on July 4th.
Oh, yeah. So everyone's having a good time.
At least they went out drunk.
So that's a verified list of people that were killed. So I think it's really plausible to any number they want to throw out. It's not out of the realm of possibility. Well, it is a long night. I think we're going to take off. Hey, thanks for listening. If you've been with us the whole time, we really appreciate it. Make sure you tell some people. Even if you don't like the show, why should you tell somebody you don't like? Okay. Don't forget to buy Ori Spado's book. It's coming out in December.
Yep.
All right. Have a great night. Thank you for listening to Partners in Crime. This week's episode is an adaptation of several different historical accounts. Music is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod. All sources and attribute links can be found in the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Partners in Crime Podcast. Links are in the show notes. If you didn't like the show, keep your mouth shut. No one likes a rat.